Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Open Dialogue with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Peter Berg. You may begin.
All right. Thank you very much, Diane, and welcome to everyone that is joining us today for our October session, kicking off the 2014-2015 ADA Audio Conference Series. The ADA Audio Conference Series is a program of the ADA National Network, which is funded through the U.S. Department of Education National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, NIDRR. My name is Peter Berg. I am the coordinator of technical assistance for the Great Lakes ADA Center. I want to welcome all of you to another brand new season of the ADA Audio Conference Series. And as usual, we have a great lineup of topics and exceptional speakers that will be joining us throughout the year. Just as a reminder, the audio and the transcript for today's session will be archived. About 15 business days from today, we will have an edited transcript that will be posted to the ada-audio.org website along with the audio transcript. Both will be available at the ADA Audio homepage. We are pleased today to have back with us a speaker that has joined us many times over the years, an exceptional presenter and great friend to the ADA National Network. And that, of course, is Sharon Rennert, who is with the ADA and GINA division with the Office of Legal Counsel for the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. For today's presentation, Sharon is going to give us an update on things that are happening at the EEOC. And once Sharon is done with her update, it is going to be the questions from all of you participants via the telephone and those of you in the webinar room submitting them electronically and questions that have come in advance that are going to drive the remainder of your of today's session. So please be thinking of your questions, and Sharon will respond to those. So at this time, without any more ado for me, I will turn it over to Ms. Sharon Rennert. Sharon?
Thank you, Peter, and welcome to everyone participating today. I want to get to your questions as quickly as possible because that's always the most interesting part of this program to me, and I hope to you, the way I can be perhaps of most service to you. But as Peter indicated, let me give you a brief update on some ADA-related developments here at the EEOC. And let me begin by saying that about a week ago, the EEOC reissued and updated its document on Schedule A. This applies to people looking for federal jobs, if they're looking to apply for jobs with federal agencies. And there is a special Special Hiring Authority, referred to as Schedule A. We have a fact sheet called the ABCs of Schedule A. If you go to EEOC's website, which is www.eeoc.gov, if you do a search at the top of the homepage, put in Schedule A, put in ABCs of Schedule A, it should bring up this document. As I said, we revised it, reissued it last week. And so for those of you who work with people who are applying for jobs and might be interested in working for the federal government, but also I know sometimes on these sessions we have federal agencies, and even you all may be finding this helpful in terms of explaining or reminding you about certain things about using Schedule A to hire qualified individuals with disabilities. We've just completed the fiscal year, the federal government's fiscal year. It ended September 30th, and that serves as a time for us to kind of look back and assess what happened, and we are in the process of doing it. It's a little too soon, a couple of weeks later, to give you a good snapshot of what fiscal year 14 looked like. We've just started fiscal year 2015, but a couple of things that already becoming clear is that the EEOC in the past few years has tried to put some new energy into our litigation program. We really can't bring thousands and thousands of lawsuits, and we don't have the resources for that, so we've always had to pick and choose carefully what we're going to litigate. But we've put a new sort of focus and emphasis in the last few years, and what I was able to find is that not quite the fiscal year, but since July of 2013, so roughly the past 14, 15 months, more than 70 of our lawsuits involved ADA allegations. So it is a significant portion of the litigation we bring. This is certainly true or impacted by the ADA Amendments Act, when we didn't have to spend quite so much time proving disability. That really opened us up to be able to litigate a wide range of issues involving lots of different kinds of disabilities. So we have, as I said, over 70 lawsuits in the period that roughly runs the fiscal year, a little bit more than that. Let me highlight a couple of recent lawsuits, because one of the things that the EEOC is doing here is trying to signal its focus on certain issues. And one issue that has gotten a lot of attention, these are actually two separate lawsuits, but they both concerned employers who adopted wellness programs. And wellness programs over the past 10 years or so have become very popular with many, many kinds of employers. They serve many purposes, not least of which is employers hope it controls rising health care costs, but also one way to control it is improving the health of their employees and their family members of employees. So lots of reasons that employers have adopted wellness programs, and the types of wellness programs, enormous variety of wellness programs. And the EEOC has been looking at this issue for many years now, but we recently filed two lawsuits, one in August, one in September, against employers who had these wellness programs. And what they have in common is that the issue under the ADA is whether or not a wellness program is considered voluntary or not. Why is that an ADA issue? Well, as I hope most of you are aware, the ADA does regulate an an employer's ability to require medical exams or ask medical questions of employees. Basically, employers must be able to show that any required medical exam, any questions, medical questions that they require employees to ask, to answer, are job-related and consistent with business necessity. That's the legal standard set out by the ADA. Those medical exams and questions must be job-related and consistent with business necessity. But the ADA has an exception, and the exception is for voluntary wellness programs. If it's a voluntary wellness program, then an employer would not be required to meet that business necessity test. But it all hinges on whether or not the program is voluntary. Because if it's voluntary, the idea here would be that employees know what they're getting into. They're choosing to enter into a wellness program. They understand they could be subjected to a medical exam or to answer medical questions in order to get the benefits of the program, but they're voluntarily choosing to do so. And the ADA is not prohibiting that and doesn't want to act as a bar to that either. But the two lawsuits that EEOC filed, it's our claim that these were not voluntary. And the reason we don't believe these wellness programs were voluntary was because of the penalties imposed on employees who refused to participate. In one of the lawsuits filed against Flambeau Incorporated, which is in Wisconsin, I believe, the company required employees to submit to biometric testing and a health risk assessment, or they would face cancellation of their medical insurance, unspecified disciplinary action for failing to attend the scheduled testing, and a requirement to pay the full premium for their medical insurance. Normally what the employer would do is it would pay 75% of the cost of the premium for health insurance. The employees would pay the other 25%. But if an employer refused to participate in this wellness program, then the employee would be required to pay 100% of the premium cost, the full premium cost, to still get medical coverage. The other lawsuit against also a Wisconsin company, Arion Energy Systems, kind of similar in terms of the penalty if employees did not participate. Again, the wellness program would require medical examinations and you'd have to answer medical questions. And if you refused, as one employee did, she objected to this, then she was going to become responsible for paying the entire premium for the health benefits. Ultimately, this particular employee was fired, and so EEOC's lawsuit is also alleging retaliation against the employee because she was objecting to these requirements that she believed would violate the ADA. So what does one take away, or what should one take away from these two lawsuits? I don't think these lawsuits are indicating EEOC's opposition to wellness programs, but I do think that EEOC looked at these two different charges, and it's the decision to file lawsuits in both when we could not reach settlements with the respective employers because of the extreme nature of the penalty here. That and how the extreme nature of the penalty undermines any concept or sense that these would be considered voluntary wellness programs. That employees faced with going from I'm paying 25% towards my health insurance premium and now I have to pay 100%, that we think that undermines any employee's ability to make a voluntary decision to participate. That pretty much is going to shove an employee into the wellness program. That most people, that's a pretty significant, hefty increase in financial responsibility. And that, we think, vitiates any sense sense that this can be considered voluntary. So I don't know that these are representative of most wellness programs being operated by employers in terms of the incentives or the penalties they may impose. This has been one of these issues that EEOC has been studying for a long time. What's the difference between using some kind of incentive versus a penalty? Is there a difference? EEOC is also very, very aware of HIPAA and the Affordable Care Act and how these address wellness programs. EEOC is, I think most people are aware, has been studying these issues for a long time. It is still EEOC's hope to issue guidance on these issues. But again, that's not something I can give you a date. I wish I could, as to when there may be some formal guidance from EEOC. But I do think that these two lawsuits are important to point out in terms of any employer who's thinking of having similar kinds of penalties. EEOC, you can tell by these lawsuits, would not look kindly on that. But I wouldn't look at these and see that, you know, if you give something far less drastic, that would be a violation of the ADA. But remember, the issue really goes to is you're if you're an employer and you're trying to decide, okay, is there some penalty I can impose, keeping in mind how would that cause an employee to view whether it is voluntary to participate or whether it really does completely undermine that sense of voluntariness. That's going to be your EEOC or your ADA issue. One other recent lawsuit filed, I think about a week ago actually, that also gives you a sense of EEOC's focus in terms of litigation, is we just filed a big lawsuit against FedEx, and it was for failing to provide reasonable accommodation to deaf workers. This lawsuit grew out of 19 individual discrimination charges filed with the EEOC from across the country. I mean, FedEx is a national company, offices all across the United States, and we had received these, as I said, 19 separate charges. EEOC has been trying over the past few years to do a better job of making sure we're aware of overlap in terms of charges coming into our offices across the country to see where we're getting multiple charges against a single employer and to really combine these cases. And again, our hope that we can settle them, that there will be no need for litigation, but if there is, as in this case, that we really are going after problems, what we call systemic problems. It's not just one particular office or facility, but there seems to be something much broader going on across the country, multiple offices, multiple facilities. And it turns out that FedEx does employ a significant number of package handlers who are deaf. But these package handlers would need reasonable accommodation for certain things that apparently were not being provided, such as sign language interpreters or closed captioning when there were training videos. And these were often mandatory trainings for all employees, not just the deaf employees, but they had no way of understanding very well what was going on without closed captioning if there were videos or without sign language interpreters. And this could be for new hire orientation, so you're just recently hired, there's an orientation program, again, not appropriate accommodation. It also extends to staff meetings and safety meetings. Also, the lawsuit is alleging that FedEx failed to provide appropriate equipment, an example being scanners that instead of beeping, which were not particularly helpful to these deaf employees, would vibrate instead. So again, different kinds of reasonable accommodations that EEOC alleges were requested were were not provided. We allege there would have been no undue hardship. So again, it is one of the focuses of EEOC's litigation these past couple of years to have more of what we call these systemic cases rather than just one individual case, something that could have a broader impact. So I will let you see about that. If you want to see more about our litigation, you can go to the EEOC website. If you scroll down to our newsroom, that's where we publish updates on litigation that we're filing, and particularly because August and September are big months for us to file litigation, it is a place where you can see a lot of the ADA litigation that has recently been filed. In terms of an upcoming event that may be of interest to many of you, on October 28th from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, EEOC is going to hold a live Twitter chat on disability employment in the federal sector. So again, if you deal with folks who are job hunting and are interested in jobs in the federal sector, or even if you're a federal agency, you may want to tune in. I'm not sure if that's the right phrase for attending a Twitter chat. But that's going to be October 28th at 2 o'clock. The EEOC Chair Jenny Yang and Commissioner Chai Feldblum will be answering questions during the hour-long chat. You can find more information, including the hashtag for that, again, if you go on to the EEOC homepage. It is advertised there. You will also see, if you go on to get information on the Twitter chat, it does provide links to various documents, and one that may be of particular interest, well, two of them. One will be the ABCs of Schedule A. There's a quick link there, but also a link to a document called ADA Litigation Related Developments, ADA Litigation Related Developments. And that has a lot of information on EEOC's ADA litigation program covering the past 3 years. And lots and lots of links, lots of good information there. So if you are interested in litigation, that's a good document to look up. In terms of regulatory activity involving the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, what we expect will come up early in 2015. And again, I can't give you a specific date or even a month, but we expect in early 2015 is that EEOC will publish what's called a notice of proposed rulemaking. In other words, we will propose regulations for public comment dealing with federal agencies and the obligation to be considered a model employer under the Rehabilitation Act. This is not for the federal sector, for the private sector. This is not for the private sector or for state and local governments as employers. This is really focused only on federal agencies as employers, that they have an independent obligation. This is not something found in the ADA, but they have an independent obligation to be a model employer. And the EEOC's current regulations have not been updated in many, many years and are rather sparse in defining what does it mean to be a model employer. So the purpose of this proposed rulemaking will be to flesh out a bit what are the obligations on federal agencies to be a model employer. What does that mean? How do they show that they are a model employer? What steps must they take? What options do they have? EEOC previously had put out what's called an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking on these various issues. We sought public input. We've been going through the public comments. comments we got and helping us to prepare now proposed regulations. So if that's of interest, look out for it sometime in the first few months of 2015. The last thing I want to touch on before we go to your questions, which may sound a little strange because this is supposed to be all about the ADA, but it's about pregnancy discrimination. And as many of you may have heard, over the summer, EEOC issued what we call an enforcement guidance on pregnancy discrimination. If you haven't seen it, the best way to find it, you go to the EEOC homepage and then you do a search. There's a search engine at the top of the page. Just type in pregnancy enforcement guidance and that will bring it right up. But EEOC issued this enforcement guidance to talk about pregnancy discrimination, and it has really two things that are relevant in terms of the ADA, which is why I'm bringing it up today. The first is there's a whole section on pregnancy-related disabilities. Thanks to the ADA Amendments Act, it makes it easier to cover a host of impairments, medical conditions, that result from being pregnant. Pregnancy, we all know, is not a disability in and of itself, but pregnancy can cause various impairments to develop. For example, there's a condition called gestational diabetes that a pregnant woman, because of her pregnancy, may develop a form of diabetes. And that is an impairment, and that could well be considered a disability under the ADA, or if you're a federal agency listening in, under the Rehabilitation Act. And it's no different. The fact that it stems from or is caused by a pregnancy is irrelevant in terms of disability coverage under the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act. Once it's a disability, it's like any other disability in terms of the protections offered by the statute, in terms of the potential right to a reasonable accommodation. So it's worth looking at that section, which does review a lot of pregnancy-related impairments that could well be considered disabilities. It talks about the kinds of reasonable accommodations that could be required. And again, it's all the same ADA rules that everybody, I think, is very familiar with at this point, but it really underscores keeping in mind that these conditions can be disabilities. The other section in the guidance that I think is important is the section on pregnancy and the protections offered not by the ADA, but by the sister statute, if you will, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which actually predates the ADA by many years. It just celebrated its 50th anniversary, the Civil Rights Act. So, this law, which protects individuals from sex discrimination, one form of sex discrimination can be pregnancy discrimination. Now, what is important in this section for, I think, many people participating today is that the EEOC takes the position that if an employer is providing accommodation for things other than pregnancy, so think disability, or think, it may not be called accommodation, but think about when you're providing things to people with work-related injuries, for example, light duty. EEOC is taking the position that if you provide those reasonable accommodations or light duty for somebody with work-related injury or with a disability, then an employer would have to provide those same types of accommodations to a pregnant woman unless the employer, when it comes to accommodations, could show undue hardship. Now, note here that we're not talking about a pregnancy-related disability. What we're talking about here is just a simple, straight-on pregnancy, okay? So there's no complications necessarily, no problems, no impairment like gestational diabetes that could be considered a disability. It's just pregnancy. But let's say, you know, by the time you get to your seventh or eighth month of pregnancy, for a lot of women, that's a lot of extra weight you're carrying. If you've got a job that requires a lot of standing, that may become difficult. The pressure on your back, the pressure on your legs. Women who can't really do that very easily simply because of a normal pregnancy. And so this is a woman who might say, look, instead of standing, which is the normal way to perform this job, can I sit down? Can I have a chair? Can I have a stool to sit on to do my job? In other words, she's requesting accommodation. And what the EEOC is saying is, in order not to violate the Civil Rights Act, in order not to engage in pregnancy discrimination, a form of sex discrimination, an employer who would provide that stool or that chair to somebody with a disability, because you know you need to do that under the ADA, you've got to provide it to this woman because of her pregnancy, unless the employer can show undue hardship. This is very important. This is very controversial. I mean, that is not news to anybody, this position the EEOC has taken. And in fact, the Supreme Court will be examining this issue in its term, which just began a couple of weeks ago. There is a case out of the Fourth Circuit called Young versus United Parcel Service, which involved a pregnant woman. She asked for light duty jobs from UPS. UPS said no. They did have light duty jobs, but they reserved it for people with work-related injuries. They also provided it to people covered under the ADA, but clearly she was not. This is not about a pregnancy-related disability. It's simply a normal garden variety pregnancy. So she didn't fall under any of the categories that UPS had to get light duty, so she was turned down. She files a lawsuit ultimately. It's made its way up to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court's going to weigh in on this issue. Oral arguments are set for early December. Remember that the Supreme Court term goes until the end of June next year. So I have no way of knowing when they will issue a decision, but it may not be until early next summer. But until then, I think it's important for people to realize the position EEOC has taken, to remember this. So if you are dealing with accommodations for people with disabilities, you may want to expand that and have the people who administer that program, maybe your frontline supervisors, maybe you have specific HR people or others who handle accommodation requests, but they should be familiar with this pregnancy guidance, what it says on accommodating women because of just pregnancy needs, not disability, but pregnancy, and to really make some informed decisions in that area. Okay, with that, Peter, why don't we go to the phones or computers or what have you and answer people's questions.
Excellent, Sharon. Thank you for the update. Diane, if you could come back, I'm going to have you give instructions to phone participants in just a moment. And to give a quick reminder for the folks in the webinar room, you can submit your questions in the chat area. Simply click on the chat area or control M to do so. Even though you can't see your questions, they are viewable by the moderators. And then also those of you connecting through your mobile app, you can submit your questions directly into the chat area. Diane, if you could give our phone participants instructions on how they can also ask questions at this point.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then one key on your touch-tone phone. If you find that your question has been answered after you've queued up, press the pound key to remove yourself from the question and answer queue.
Thanks, Sharon. While we wait to get some questions on the phone, just a quick follow-up on the second lawsuit that you mentioned regarding FedEx, and the question was about, does the EEOC currently have the ability to monitor complaints, common complaints, real time, or to identify employers that are having multiple complaints filed against them from around the different field offices, or is that something that has to be flushed out over a period of time, months?
I don't know that it's like real time, that instantaneously we can tell that, oh, we've got a charge in our New York office and we have a charge in our LA office, but I also don't know that it's taking months. I think that we have managed to figure out, and I'm the worst person to talk about technology because I'm a 19th century person when it comes to technology, but I do believe our technology has been refined so that, like with keywords and things like that, can pick out, so obviously the name of a company, and that can flash and send information that, oh, wait a minute, like we've got multiple cases against a particular company. I don't know if it necessarily tells us immediately what the allegations are, whether that's going to require a human being to at least look into it a bit, but it may say, for example, ADA, it may say reasonable accommodation, so some key words that are tending to show that we may have some overlapping cases, and then looking to make sure that, is it really the same issue like we found with the FedEx case, or are they really, it may all be reasonable accommodation, for example, but it's really covering a lot of different areas of accommodation. There really isn't overlap to combine them all. So I think it's not necessarily the real time, but it's certainly a lot less than a few months. We do have an ability much more quickly than that now to identify overlap.
Excellent. And Diane, at this time, do we have any questions on the telephone?
At this time, we have no questions.
All right. Let's go to electronic questions. This is a coverage question, Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
The questioner is asking, if an individual owns two businesses, both of which have less than 10 employees, and the two businesses are kept separate in terms of separate payroll, separate bank accounts, and so forth, would that business owner have any ADA obligation? So it's two businesses that they operate, pizza place and a hotel, both have less than 10 employees.
Okay, so they are different businesses. I was going to ask if we knew that, but you said one's a hotel and one's a pizza place. There are all kinds of basically factors that go into deciding whether it's what would be referred to as an integrated enterprise, that it really is one employer, and therefore we combine the two businesses so that we get to the magic number of you have to have a minimum of 15 employees to have coverage under the laws enforced by EEOC, or whether, no, they are just two distinct and separate. And I've learned to be a bit careful here. You've certainly hit on some of the relevant factors, the types of businesses, the fact that I think I heard you say we've got separate payroll system. Those are all things we look at, but because there are a number of other factors that could be looked at, including the, while they may be separate, are they basically the same kind of pay system? It may be separate HR, but it's really laid out the same way. Is there any common individuals other than whoever owns the business? Are there any other managerial kinds of figures that have a relationship with both businesses? So we would be looking, or I would tell any employer, to really very carefully examine that to see whether there is the potential. Obviously, an employer can also seek counsel to get a legal opinion as to whether or not the two businesses could be considered one for purposes of coverage under the civil rights laws. I also tell employers, please remember to check your state laws. There are a number of state civil rights laws that have a lower threshold than the 15. So even if you would not be covered in terms terms of the ADA say, could you potentially be covered by a state disability discrimination law, which sets a lower threshold here? So that's about the best I can say in answer to that question.
Excellent. Very good. It's two service animal questions, so I'm going to ask them both. One's a specific scenario, and another's a more general or question about guidance. So the first is a question. The individual states that he's a vet that has PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and has a trained service animal that he wants to bring into the workplace. And it indicates that he has made a request to his employer, and the employer is requesting a couple pieces of documentation from the individual. One, that the animal, in fact, has gone through a training, and two, that the individual, the employee, has insurance for the animal in case something happens in the workplace, that the individual, the employee, has insurance coverage. And then the more general question is someone is asking separately, is the EEOC going to issue any guidance on service animals as a reasonable accommodation in the workplace?
Well, let me answer the second question first because it's the easier one. Unfortunately, no. There are no plans at the moment. Now, things can change always, but at the moment, there are not plans to issue guidance on service animals. Remember, it would be the admission, basically, of service animals as a reasonable accommodation. No employer would have to actually provide the service animal as a form of reasonable accommodation, but the issue would be admitting the animal onto the employer's premises. But not at the moment do I know of any plans to issue guidance. In terms of the veteran with PTSD, in terms of the employer asking some questions, well, that's certainly permissible under the interactive process. So requesting documentation that the animal really has been trained for the purposes that the employee is saying that the animal is trained for, absolutely can request it. I think you can also request information about whether the individual has insurance to cover any thing the animal might do. Now, to say that you can request the information then just leads, I think, to a different question. Suppose that there isn't insurance. You know, what happens then? And I would certainly tell an employer to be careful about insisting that an employee have insurance. First of all, I'm not even sure. I guess you can get insurance for anything and everything. But that is not an area I am familiar with. So to the extent that there's any possibility there is no such thing, or it's very difficult to come by, or it's just very outrageously expensive, or even if it's not, I'm not sure that an employer should be insisting on it. I would be careful. To the extent that the employer has certain concerns, why are they even raising the question about insurance? What are they concerned about? First of all, some of that may be answered in terms of an understanding of what kind of training the animal has gone through. The other thing that I'm a big proponent on, and this may be a good circumstance for using it, is a trial period. This is not something that the ADA addresses because it would be too much micromanaging for the statute to get into these kinds of details. But I think in a certain number of circumstances, a trial period, a chance to try out a reasonable accommodation, in this case allowing the animal into the workplace. A trial period gives the employer and the employee a chance to see how well this works. And so to the extent that some of the concerns and that are behind this question about insurance could be answered, I mean, animals certainly have to be able to be at all times within the control of their owner, cannot be aggressive. Forget kinds of insurance issues. I've had to deal with issues of dogs that just don't stop barking. And I don't mean barking because that, you know, there's a sort of threat to their owner and, you know, that's what they do. That's what they're trained to. I'm talking about, as it would turn out, you know, a dog that really hasn't been trained. And as many dogs, you know, some are excitable and whatever, but they're being disruptive in the workplace. They are not performing a service for their owner, but they are being disruptive to the workplace. Well, that's not necessarily going to be an insurance issue, but it can be a very legitimate issue to getting work done. And so a trial period allows, as I said, both employer and employee to see how well something works. And that's what I would sort of emphasize to an employer. Is to do a trial period so that they don't, you know, fixate on the insurance or the lack of insurance, if it turns out there isn't any, as a reason to justify refusing admittance to the animal. I'd be a bit concerned. And again, in the absence of EEOC guidance, I am not aware of any court cases that have looked at that issue. I don't pretend that I know every ADA or Rehabilitation Act lawsuit ever filed, but I am not aware of anything, and I don't like employers to be the test cases of something. So if there's another way to get at what those concerns are, I think that the employer should be straightforward with the individual. What are the concerns behind that question? Because there may be other ways to address it.
All right, and just to stay with this topic, not to get bogged down on it, but the questions that I've gotten in over the technical assistance phone lines at the ADA Center, and then another question that someone just submitted here is some confusion between the Department of Justice mm-hmm. definition of service animals under Titles 2 and 3 that apply to state and local governments and also apply to, under Title 3, to private businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, you know, how the EEOC views or defines service animal versus the DOJ, you know, limitations and what the folks can ask under Titles 2 and 3?
I think it's, first of all, very important for people to remember that what the Justice Department addressed in Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA, as we know, they have gone into a lot of detail about what kinds of animals are covered as service animals, how they define a service animal, but that's all applying to Titles 2 and 3 of the ADA. It doesn't apply to Title 1 of the ADA, the employment provisions, which is what the EEOC enforces. And so again, in the absence of either regulations or other kinds of guidances issued by the EEOC on this topic, I can't say in terms of does the commission fully agree or disagree or what have you. There's just no way to answer that question. I think certainly at a minimum, the way DOJ defined a service animal, I can't see EEOC saying no dogs trained as service animals, no matter what kind of service they perform, whether it's for a physical disability or a mental illness, that no, that's not something that the admittance of a dog like that into a workplace would never be a form of reasonable accommodation. Obviously, that would have to be considered potentially a form of reasonable accommodation. I think the issue under the employment provisions of the ADA that's outstanding is what about what we might call comfort animals? Remember that the Justice Department regulations specifically exclude comfort animals. The defined basically as a dog or any other animal, I guess, that is not performing some kind of service. It's more just the presence of the animal brings comfort to its owner, but not that it's trained as like a seeing eye dog or to hear for a person or to alert a person she's about to have a seizure or to have a PTSD episode, where that kind of training is required to be considered a service animal. So it really is the outstanding, probably the biggest question that comes into EEOC, which we just can't definitively answer at this point, is whether employers as a form of reasonable accommodation potentially must admit comfort animals. I've certainly encouraged employers to be open about it. Again, use the interactive process. first of all, what kind of animal are we talking about? What kind of training are we talking about? How exactly does it help the individual? Again, look at the kind of job. Some jobs may make it very difficult to have an animal present. And is it about holding? I mean, a service animal is not necessarily being held. If somebody says, I can't let go of my comfort animal, and yet they have a job in which they're going to need to use their hands, their arms, and no, you can't do it constantly holding an animal, there may be some very practical issues that could get in the way here. In terms of the ability to sit at its owner's feet, is this animal really been trained to do this? Again, you know, an animal that's going to wander off or the owner has to keep calling, you know, come back here, Fluffy, that could be problematic. Again, the trial period. Remember that that's available. It's a tool, if you will, and it could be a useful one in this area. But again, unless and until either we have an EEOC issue, something, or as I said, courts. Really, courts, there have not really been a lot of cases involving the use of, be it service animals, comfort animals, in the employment context. So we don't even have a whole lot there as guidance.
Okay, that's great. And we'll move on. The DOJ regulations do limit service animals to dogs
right, only.
All right, let's go. Diane, let's check and see if we have a call on the phone at this time.
We do not have a call on the phone at this time, but let me just give them
instructions again. Real quick. Thanks.
If you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. Again, please press the star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Thank you.
All right. Well, we're waiting for them. We still have questions coming in from folks in the webinar and submitting them electronically. And this questioner has this individual has a question about work from home. And the question indicates that the employer has deep, deep resources, so undue hardship is not an issue in terms of allowing someone to work from home. But the work, workplace structure does not support work from home. Or the model does not support work from home. What are the obligations in that instance to consider telework or work from home as a reasonable accommodation?
Well, a little hard to give a definitive answer because we don't have a lot of facts to go on here. I'm not sure the answer, at least as I might interpret the word resources, is really going to help us here to the extent the employer has deep resources. That may not really be the most important issue as to whether or not telework as a reasonable accommodation is or is not possible. In terms of the workplace model, again, the reminder for an employer is always that reasonable accommodation is meant to have employers do something differently. Fundamentally, that's what it's all about, is that it is something the employer otherwise doesn't have to do. I mean, if it's something they're already doing, then you don't need to have an obligation to provide reasonable accommodation. So almost by definition, it is an employer doing something differently. Now, how differently, or what does doing something differently, what's the result of that to the rest of the operations? Well, it may result in an undue hardship. Again, not knowing enough about the workplace model that is referenced in the question, we don't know what the specific job is. And again, I think it's very hard to talk about something like telework, almost any accommodation across the board. You really need to know what kind of job we're talking about, and that's especially true when we're talking about telework. Obviously, there are certain jobs that never could be performed outside the workplace. You know, common sense alone would tell us not feasible to do it. For other kinds of jobs, there may be parts of the job that could be performed from home home or other off-site location, but not every aspect of it. Some of it would have to be performed in the workplace. So, and I'm putting aside right now that the disability does necessitate telework. Obviously, that's an issue too. Why is it that somebody's disability requires either part-time or even potentially full-time telework? But leaving that side of the equation out for the moment, in terms of the job itself, what is it that the person needs to do, and how would they do it from a remote location? This is a type of accommodation that I think requires quite an in-depth discussion between the employee and the employer, really getting into the weeds, if you will, about the person's ability to do job duties. You've got to go through each one of them that could potentially be performed from home or might need to be performed from home or the other remote location. The kinds of equipment or other resources the person needs to do their job. Is this stuff they would have to take from the workplace? Is it stuff they would have at their home? Is it stuff they can get just working on a computer that they can log into certain things? What about dealing with coworkers? How would that work? Of course, technology can be a big assistance here, but it may not permit all the kinds of interactions that is needed. What about if you're working with the public or clients or anybody outside your coworkers? How is that going to work? Supervision type issues. Obviously, people are still needing to be supervised. How is that going to work? What about the hours, the availability? How does it impact the ability of coworkers to do their jobs? If everybody is working together, a kind of a team concept, or even if it's not defined as such, a lot of us, I know in my job, I have things that I do with colleagues, and it's important that I share my work with them and they share their work with me in a timely way. If I were looking to telework, how would that work out? And so I think it's very important, as I said, to kind of get into tremendous detail. And here again, I'll put in my pitch for trial period. Unless an employer really can see that there's undue hardship, and in some cases that may be pretty self-evident, that an employer can show there's just undue hardship in providing telework, then I encourage both the employer and the employee to consider the tool of a trial period. 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Again, it doesn't replace or displace the kind of conversation I was talking about a moment ago. I think that has to occur first. But if you go through that kind of conversation and it really isn't clear that an employer has an undue hardship right now, that if that they could really lay out the undue hardship grounds for turning down this request, but they have concerns. Would this really work? Then the trial period may be a great option to find out for sure. Good faith on both sides, employee trying to make it work, employer trying to make it work, but maybe it doesn't. And maybe in trying it out for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and what I say is, whatever period you start out with a trial period, if it's been pretty successful, extend the trial period. Do another 2-3 weeks. Keep seeing, for a bit. Now, if it keeps being successful, at some point, I think an employer has to provide, not just on the trial period. But I think it's a terrific option for both sides, for an employee to show that she really can make it work, for an employer to make sure it's working as it's intended to. So if some of this workplace model issue, again, without more specifics, hard to say definitive answer, but maybe the trial period would help to see whether, despite the way the workplace is set up, whether an individual teleworking could still, within that concept, do a successful job of performing his or her work.
All right, thank you. Another question from the webinar room. Does an individual, an employee with a physical disability that uses a walker, cane, or wheelchair have to make a request for a reasonable accommodation in order to use the device in the workplace?
I shouldn't think so. I mean, somebody who's using a cane or a walker or a wheelchair, no. I mean, an employer that approaches somebody and says, throw away your wheelchair, don't bring that in here without making a request, I would strongly urge that person to immediately contact the EEOC. That, I think, is, you know, it's like going up to a person who is deaf and who's got a hearing aid on, you know, and can I bring my hearing aid into your premises? I mean, unless there is something that I'm trying to conceive of the fact where I'd see, you know, somebody has to ask for permission to bring their walker in or their cane in. If an employer has some concerns about, there's something about the layout that's raising a concern for them about someone who's using a walker or cane or some similar device, then go ask the question. I mean, that's what I would tell an employer to do, not to tell somebody you can't bring that in here or you didn't ask my permission to. So I'm just wondering what else is going on here behind that question.
Right. Right. No other details on that one. I got another general question I'll ask before we check the phones again. This questioner wants to know, what is considered an undue hardship change over time, i.e. something that originally was an accommodation that originally wasn't an undue hardship, but over time has become an undue hardship for the employer?
Again, it's a good question, but it's also a difficult one to give a sort of a definitive answer to, because it really is going to depend on the circumstances. One of the examples that I gave, certainly a few years ago when the recession began, and you had any number of employers that were laying off, firing workers. I mean, their businesses were suffering, and they had to, unfortunately, lay off or fire people. And so one of the examples at that time I would give for a potential undue hardship, something that did not start out being an undue hardship, maybe because now there were fewer workers available. So for example, removal of marginal functions, a type of reasonable accommodation, or modifying work hours, another form of reasonable accommodation, when initially provided, no undue hardship. But that was premised on having a certain number of workers available. And so say with modifying workplace hours, well, we had other workers available to cover hours so we could modify somebody's schedule as a reasonable accommodation. Now we don't have those other workers. And if we continue with the accommodation, we might have no coverage in, you know, at the workplace at a certain time for a job where, you know, we're open for business at this point and we need to have somebody there. So there was an example of something that did not start out as being an undue hardship, but circumstances change. And so what I think is important here, if an employer is feeling that's what's happening, is again the importance of communication with employees. That really to me is the touchstone of the whole reasonable accommodation obligation, is the communication required on both parties, the individual with the disability and the employer, and that both of them have certain types of information that need to be shared with the other to make this work. And sometimes it may be that there isn't a reasonable accommodation that can be provided, or one that was provided for a certain period of time, as this question's raising, has now become an undue hardship. But I think it's important for the employer to go to the person and to lay out what's happened and why the employer believes either it is now an undue hardship or it's going to become one. Maybe we're not quite there, but hey, you know, we're starting to lay off people and maybe things will improve and we won't lay off anymore, but, you know, wanted to raise with you, we may have a problem. And maybe it's time for employer and employee to start brainstorming. Hey, if we get to the point that we're going to lay off some more people and that means the modified schedule or the removal of marginal functions won't work anymore, is there anything else we can do? Kind of, you know, a contingency plan, if you will, is that you may start planning for something that hasn't happened yet. But the better the communication, the more open it is between employer and employee, trusting each other. I mean, these are huge things. I don't say any of this lightly. But I think the more that there is that trust, that communication, that looking ahead, that sharing back and forth of information, that sense of it's a problem, let's see if we can solve it together, that's the best way to have this go as well as it can, this whole interactive process, the reasonable accommodation process. You know, coming up at the last minute to somebody, well, you know, 6 months ago we could see the handwriting on the wall, and now we've reached that point, and it's an undue hardship, and so we're yanking away your reasonable accommodation. It may be right legally, but no surprise that the individual is caught off guard and is unhappy and whatever. You know, it's not always about coming up with a happy ending, but nonetheless, I think the more that we've got this communication going on both sides, the better for everybody.
Okay. Thank you. And let's see if we have any questions on the phone at this time. Diane?
We have no questions on the phone
at
this time.
All right.
This is a computer crowd. They just type in their questions.
This is a question from someone that writes that they've noticed recently on some online applications that they've been completing, employers asking individuals to disclose if they have a disability. The individual writes that afterwards has learned that these are federal contractors that are subject to the new DOL, Department of Labor, Section 503 rule. And the questioner wants to know, at what point can federal contractors under this new rule ask applicants to disclose if they have a disability, and how can that information be used?
Okay, if it's a federal contractor, as the question is referencing, they are covered under Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is similar to the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act's anti-discrimination provisions as they apply to federal agencies as employers. But Section 503 also has an affirmative action requirement. And what I can't tell from this question is whether the inquiry about disability has anything to do with the affirmative action section of the 503 regulation. As the questioner noted, and I lose track of time, a few months ago, maybe it's as much as a year ago now, the Department of Labor did issue new 503 regulations. It has a whole section on affirmative action, and I would really refer anybody to Department of Labor specifically to ask about questions about disability on an application, and this was on an application, as to whether it was consistent with what federal contractors are required to do or permitted to do under those regulations, or whether it is a violation, both in terms of the non-discrimination part of Section 503, as well as potentially a violation of the ADA. Federal contractors are covered under both the ADA employment provisions as well as the Section 503 anti-discrimination. So again, without more information, maybe this is something that is being done consistent with affirmative action, but generally what's required is to spell that out. If it's just, you know, a long list of questions that's asking about your education, your job experience, and then they simply throw in suddenly without any explanation, and by the way, do you have any disabilities, I don't think that's going to meet the 503 requirements, and that could would definitely sound illegal, in which case I would tell an individual, contact within Department of Labor, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, or contact the EEOC, or contact both agencies.
All right, great. Get a number of questions coming in from the webinar room. This is a question. Says an individual uses an oversized wheelchair that the individual is unable to get into the space in the office where he works, and the employer has told the individual that on days when he needs to use that oversized wheelchair, he needs to use a cane or walker to get into his workspace. What options does this employee have with regards to this employer?
Okay. I don't think an employer should be telling people what to use or not to use. These are personal use items, the wheelchair, a cane, a walker, and if nothing else, you know, what I usually will tell employers when it comes to these kinds of personal use items, if this person, say, starts using a cane or a walker and falls down, then expect that there's going to be a lawsuit, a negligence lawsuit filed against you. I think if there's no other reason to refrain as an employer from saying, I want you to use these things, is because you don't want, as the employer, to be getting a lawsuit like that, that somebody is injured in that way, and, oh, but my employer made me do it. My employer told me to use it. So, you know, separate and apart from any potential ADA liability issues here, if this wheelchair does not allow entry into the workspace, I mean, a couple of things. First is I'm not sure if the problem is the size of the entryway, that the wheelchair is so large that it just doesn't physically permit entry because the door or the entryway is narrower than that. In which case, reasonable accommodation could be, is there another workspace available where this person could work, hopefully within the workplace itself, depending on the job and whether telework is even possible, that could also be looked at as an option. But I would be looking to see if there's another work site, workplace available for this person. If they can't physically, because as I said, the entryway is just too narrow. If there's some other problem that's going on here, something dealing with the floor or the angle of it or something, then maybe there is a reasonable accommodation that would permit easier entry for this person. I don't know if it's about doing some kind of a ramp, a very low kind of thing. I'm not picturing that this would be something very high, an obstacle, but I don't know whether attaching in a certain way, grab bars. I mean, this is where I'm on the phone, because I'm old-fashioned. I don't use computers. I use phones, with the Job Accommodation Network or similar resources to talk about. Once I know in more detail what the problem is, are there accommodations out there to address it? But I would be going down those roads as opposed to having an employer pushing the idea of get out of that wheelchair and use something else. I mean, I don't even know if it's physically possible for somebody to use something like a walker or a cane. And even if, as I said, it is potentially physically possible, I just think it's a big mistake for employers to be insisting, requiring, suggesting. I just would, as an employer, stay away from it.
Okay. We have another question from an employer perspective, wanting to know, or the scenario is that they have an employee that has seizures in the workplace approximately once a week, and the doctor is returning the individual back to work for full duty each time, and the employer has questions as to what are the responsibilities in terms of a safety, direct threat to other employees or to the individual, the employee themselves, in terms of allowing the employee to return back to the workplace.
Well, first of all, we don't know what kind of job it is, what kind of workplace settings, what kinds of things might be raising for this employer the concerns about direct threat. And those are important to know because I don't know whether we have...
I'm sorry, it's a retail environment. I missed it.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
So we have a retail environment, but even there, I don't know, is this somebody who's back in the stock room? Is this a salesperson who's on the retail floor? Is this a cashier? Even the stock person may be coming into the store to restock shelves or move merchandise around. But again, so that's the other part of it, is certainly what is their job. In terms of the types of seizures this person's having, I heard once a week, week. But what kinds of seizures? There's all kinds. I don't know whether this is someone who's got a seizure where they're just basically blanking out for a few seconds or a minute, whether we have somebody who in effect loses consciousness and could, you know, fall to the floor if they're standing. So what's going on here? It also sounds as though there have been at least several incidents in the workplace. I may be misinterpreting the question, but if there has been several incidents, what happened? I mean, did the person injure him or herself? I'm sort of hard pressed to see injuring anybody else, but you know, again, what has experience indicated in terms of harm to the individual or harm to other people? Some people, and certainly by no means all, but some people with seizure disorders get what's called an aura, a kind of a warning that a seizure is coming on. And this may give them a little bit of time, not necessarily, we're not talking like 20 minutes. Sometimes it's a matter of a few seconds. Sometimes I've heard it could be, you know, 30, 40 seconds. But that may be sufficient time to get out of harm's way. If they're holding something, they put it down. If they're depending on the layout, this may not be possible in a retail store. Some people can, instead of standing, can sit down, or they can move to a less populated area. So something that they can do, the individual can do, if they have this aura, this kind of advance warning that a seizure is coming on. But again, that doesn't work for all seizures. Most people don't get them, so that's not kind of going to solve this problem necessarily. But I think this is, again, a discussion that needs to happen. I think the employer should approach the person if they haven't already. And again, just to say, look, we're concerned, because that's what I heard from the question. We're concerned here. We want to make sure you're fine. We want to know if there's anything we need to think about doing. Obviously, if it's a retail store, if this could happen with customers, we need to, you know, we want to protect your dignity and your privacy as much as possible. We also want to think of our customers. We don't want to do the wrong thing. We don't want people, you know, there's a lot of mythology around what to do with or not to do with people with seizures. We don't want anybody doing something that could actually harm you, unlike the seizure itself. So having that kind of approach, that kind of conversation, getting more information from the individual, depending on the kinds of questions, potentially some more information from their doctor, how long they've been dealing with the seizure disorder, where else they've worked. If they've been working in retail for any number of years, are there anything that, you know, a former employer did that maybe the current employer ought to be considering doing as well to assist the person? So I respect the concerns coming up here, and the best way to begin to handle it is to, again, have a conversation with the individual.
All right. Thank you. This question is from someone that's working with an individual that is blind and because of transportation issues needs to be dropped off about an hour and a half before her start time. Starts 8 o'clock in the morning and has requested to be able to start earlier than that 8 o'clock start time. And the response from the employer is a claim that it's an undue hardship because they don't have the need for additional staff at that time in the morning. And the question is, you know, is that a legitimate argument or defense from the employer?
Again, it's hard to answer without having specifics about what the job is. If this is a person whose job is to work with customers, say, and so they arrive 90 minutes before the place of business opens, and really all of their job is working with customers, but there aren't any, then I can see an employer saying it's an undue hardship. I mean, you know, the job duties of this person doesn't really allow for anything to be done. But even in that kind of situation, what I might explore with an employer, remembering removal or substitution of marginal functions, if everything about the job involves working with customers. Obviously, you don't change the essential functions. You don't change that at all. But every job has both essential and marginal functions. If there are marginal functions that you could take from this person, potentially give to somebody else, and give instead this person, you know, marginal functions that they could perform that don't involve interacting with customers that they could be doing before the place of business opens. Now, that may not work in this situation, but I offer it up because the best thing an employer and employee can do is really brainstorm. It's what you might say thinking outside the box. Don't be overly rigid here. Really kind of step back, look at the biggest picture possible, and sometimes there are solutions that are not immediately obvious, like changing around marginal functions. Now, changing around the marginal functions may not cover the whole 90-minute period. Maybe it's only half an hour. So the person may well have to sit for an hour, but for 30 minutes, they've got something they can be doing as a reasonable accommodation and without causing undue hardship to the employer. But again, it's really about the details, about what it is this person does, what it is that the employer thinks may be an undue hardship about letting somebody start 90 minutes earlier. And again, even if you can't give them something for the entire 90 minutes. I'd be saying, if you can do 30 minutes without an undue hardship, then do the 30 minutes. I mean, it still gets you further along than where you began.
All right, excellent. Thank you. And now a question regarding accommodation for an employee that is pregnant. I guess this could be applicable for an employee with a disability, but the question is, as an accommodation for a pregnant employee, would an employer be required to eliminate an essential job function? And they give the example of an employee working in a correctional facility that is unable to restrain a detainee.
And the answer there is no. That to the extent what we're talking about here is pregnancy, okay? Nothing about a pregnancy-related disability. So we're not dealing with the ADA. We are dealing with the Civil Rights Act with its protection against discrimination based on pregnancy. That as I began this presentation talking about the EEOC position, that you give accommodations for pregnancy that you would be giving potentially to an employee with a disability. Well, as we all know, you never ever give or you never ever remove an essential function as a form of reasonable accommodation. So that's not something you're going to do for an employee based on disability. You do not have to do it based on pregnancy. So if restraining an inmate is an essential function of this employee's position, and again, I always tell, I'm not saying it's not, and I've looked at these kinds of circumstances and I've concluded, yes, they're essential functions, but I never do it, you know, for all these kinds of jobs. I don't look at it globally. I always look at the specific position at a specific institution. Make sure it's an essential function for this particular employee to do this particular job duty. If you determine it is an essential function, then no, you do not have to remove it based on pregnancy. You'd have to see if there's anything else that could be done as a reasonable accommodation. Don't overlook that maybe there's something else, maybe not. But no, you don't have to remove an essential function.
All right, and thank you. And a question regarding an employer's defense of undue hardship, a financial undue hardship. And the questioner is asking, if a charge were filed and investigated by EEOC, would EEOC take into consideration the financial state of it? And this is with a state agency, of that state agency or that state government as a whole, in looking at whether or not undue hardship for related to expense would be a legitimate defense.
I I think, and I'm going to emphasize the I think here as opposed to a kind of global pronouncement, I think EEOC would look at the resources available to the state agency. It's all well and good to sort of say kind of hypothetically, well, the legislature could have appropriated more money to this particular agency, but that's all hypothetical. You know, the agency has, I'm assuming, a certain appropriation from the legislature each year. Here's what you have. And I don't think that we'd be looking at, you know, what the legislature might have done or look at, you know, the entire state government budget. Again, if this is the Department of Revenue, you know, what the Department of Education may have in terms of its resources, well, wait a minute, that's for the, you know, that's what the legislature gave to the Department of Education. And so it's no good looking at that in terms of what the Department of Revenue has to work with in terms of providing reasonable accommodation. So, you know, unless there is some fact that's missing here, I'd say for a state government, we would look at the state agency and its potential resources in terms of judging the validity of a claim of financial undue hardship.
All right, let's sneak in one more question before we get to the end at the bottom of the hour. And hopefully this is a simple one. Are there any additional plans by EEOC? Are there any other guidance documents or materials that are in the process of being updated to reflect any changes in the as a result of the Amendments Act, or are all those materials and guidance documents up to date to reflect the changes in the Amendments Act?
No, unfortunately, not all of our existing documents have been brought up to date in light of the ADA Amendments Act. You can tell which ones have because there's no warning at the front of the document. If you go onto the EEOC website and look up documents, the ones we've updated have no warning telling you we've yet to update it. If you still see that warning saying we need to update it, then you know that we still have to make revisions. Then we are trying to proceed with that. Again, it's really impossible for me to say which documents next will be updated, when you'll see those changes. But this past year, we did several of them. We started with the disability-specific documents, deafness, blindness, intellectual disabilities, cancer. Those have all been updated. Other ones are still waiting their turn in line. And we hope as soon as possible to get those updated.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Sharon. We still had questions coming in, and we appreciate your knowledge and expertise in addressing the questions and providing us an update from the EEOC. It is always an excellent time when you present as part of our audio conference. For those of you that didn't have a chance to ask your questions or didn't think of your question until the very end, you can always contact your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232 or by visiting the ADA National Network website to locate your regional ADA center. The National Network website is at www.adata.org. You can find all of the information that Sharon was mentioning, guidance documents and new materials on the EEOC homepage. That's at www.eeoc.gov. Just as a quick reminder, the next session in the audio conference series will be an ADA case law update that will take place on November the 18th. Registration is now open for that upcoming session. We will have Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg from Equip for Equality as our presenters in November. You can get information about that session and register for that session by visiting www.ada-audio.org or by calling 877-232-1990. As a quick reminder, today's session has been recorded. The audio archive will be available in approximately 72 hours. We'll get that posted to ada-audio.org and in approximately 15 business days, an edited transcript of the session will also be available on the ADA audio homepage. Thanks to Sharon Rennert for presenting today. Thanks to all of you for participating. We look forward to having you all join us in November. Thank you, and have a great day.